This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost here with you on DAB across the country, online and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until midday, sharing ideas about money. I'm joined in the studio today by editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to talk through some of the stories on their website they've been investigating over the last 7 days. And on the agenda today.
Well, today we have a stark warning from the IMF.
Still a difficult market and we need to invest.
I don't see why there should be disruption to trade.
Well, believe it or not, the firing gun's only just gone off to mark the start of official campaigning ahead of June's EU referendum amid dire warnings from the IMF, the World Bank and the Bank of England about the impact of Brexit on our economy. Throw in inflation figures, interest rates, house price stats that we got this week. And just how are we shaping up? Well, the picture's not looking too rosy if you're wanting to get on the housing ladder in the next few years.
The only way I foresee it being possible to own my own property is if I move well away from London and Essex.
Better news, though, for our over 65 listeners. The team have been looking at the 10 pots of cash and freebies that you could be entitled to, and importantly, how to claim them. Now, Simon has been tackling the conundrum. Just how do you solve a problem like inheritance tax? David Cameron, are you listening?
It does seem extremely unfair. Against that, you would have people arguing that you could have people who just consistently passed down through the family, and therefore that person who's now leaving it didn't actually earn it at all.
Also today, mind your bank balance as bank account fraud reaches epic proportions, we're hearing. If you're a victim, well, it looks like you're on your own. And we look at which university subjects ultimately pay off and those that don't.
I did journalism, broadcast and film, and it was none of those exciting things, really. It was just a lot of reading dusty old books, regurgitating other people's opinions, so absolutely, I would not go.
So I've been asking today, I want to know if you could go back in time to change the degree that you took. Would you? What would it be? Would you not take one at all? Or, because we're not discriminatory here, if you didn't go to university, do you regret it now? And do you think what you did impacted on your earnings? A very good morning, Simon. Welcome back, fresh from your holidays. Good morning, Lee.
Hello, Georgie.
Simon, question to you.
I studied English and philosophy at university because I wanted to study it. I didn't do it because I thought university would get me a better job or anything like that. And actually, at one point, I was considering not going to university. And then I decided that I would go because I wanted to learn more. Mm-hmm. But to be honest, I found my university experience mildly disappointing. I very much enjoyed my time at university, but I basically did about 6 or 7 hours a week. And I really think that there was way too much being left on your own, you know, go read, you do English and philosophy, so you should go read some books. And then we'll spend an hour once a week discussing this. But then 10 minutes is taken by people settling down at the start. 10 minutes is taken by people leaving at the end. So realistically, you're doing 40 minutes a week of each of the topics that you're doing. And I didn't really feel that was enough. And I did ask one of my tutors about this when I was there, because he said that my, you know, how I was in a seminar wasn't reflected in my essays. I found writing the essays quite difficult because I was totally out of practice. And I said, you know, I didn't really feel I was getting that much out of it. And he said that universities were basically a victim of their own success. He said, if you'd been here 15 years ago, it would have been much more like the sort of Oxbridge scenario where you had more meetings, individual meetings with your tutor and things like that. But at the time I was there, they had so many more people coming in the door, they just couldn't physically do that anymore. And there was also a lot of pressure on universities to do research. You know, they get judged on the research that they do. And that research that they're doing, it doesn't include time spent actually teaching the undergraduates.
Would you change it, though? Would you go back and do something different?
What I would do is I would go back with the extra maturity that I have now and probably spend more of the free time trying to get immersed in all of the different opportunities that university offers you. Because the great thing about university is, yeah, okay, there's the teaching element, but then there's all those other things that you can do and things that you can immerse yourself in. And I think it's very hard for people in their early 20s to take advantage of that. I mean, I didn't go straight from school. I had a year where I went and did a snowboard season, and then I travelled a bit. So I probably had a bit, and I was used to working, so I had a bit more maturity than someone who just goes straight from school who's never had a job. But even then, I didn't take full advantage of it. And I would provide a counterpoint being my brother, who was never particularly academic He's bright, but he wasn't particularly academic. He did 3 or 4 years of working, did snowboard seasons, worked as a chef, worked in the building trade. Then he went to university and he did really well and got really engaged with it. So
I was the other way, Simon. I forgot you're actually there at university to learn. But this is not really appropriate to me because I decided to go back to university twice more after my first degree. So I was never very decisive. Lee, for you?
I studied creative writing and journalism. Bit like Simon. I found it mildly disappointing, to put it in Simon's words. There wasn't enough teaching.
How many lectures did you got? I got 4 a week, so you got 7.
By my final year, I was down to 4 hours a week. And the problem was with that was that 3 of them were on the same day. So basically, you sleep in one day a week, and that's it. You've missed a whole week of university. And believe me, there was a couple of weeks in a row where I managed to do that. Lee.
Very similar story, to be honest with you. I mean, it was I reckon 6 hours a week maximum. It wasn't a lot. You could have condensed my 3 years into 1 year quite easily, I think. I found A-levels more difficult. What happened, very similar to Simon, I'd have about 12 essays in for the same day. It wasn't like, you know, staggered. It was like you've got to write a 30,000-word start of a book and it's in next week. And there was many, many an all-nighter. But the most beneficial thing I did was my NCTJ, which is the newspaper qualification. It was really hands-on. You know, went into newsrooms, learnt my trade. If I went back now, I would have just tried to get straight onto an NCTJ or do a newspaper internship.
Right.
The thing, actually, I would say, I did an NCTJ the same as Lee. In fact, we both did it at Harlow, didn't we?
We did indeed.
Weren't there at the same time? Both did it at Harlow. 6-month courses. And it was, you know, you spent time in the classroom, but you did a lot of writing. You know, you did work experience as part of it where you were writing with a paper, but you were doing a lot of writing. There was, you know, and they were teaching you how to write and how to write concisely. And some of that does take an element of drumming out any sense of personality from what you're writing. But it does teach you how to write cleanly and concisely. And actually, I think I would have done better in my degree if I'd have done the 6-month NCTJ course first and then gone and done the 3-year degree in English and Philosophy. I think my essays would have been much better.
So I'm wondering, looking at the university subjects that ultimately paid off, where creative writing, philosophy and history came in on those. We shall find out.
On digital radio across the UK and online, this is Share Radio.
A very warm welcome if you've just joined us. I'm Georgie Frost. This is Share Radio. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up, running through some of the stories that they've been looking at over the last week. And I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce in partnership with NS&I. And coming up, how do you solve a problem like inheritance tax if you're the victim of a bank account fraud, you're on your own, and we take a look at which university subjects ultimately pay off and those that do not. But first, today marks the official start of campaigning ahead of June's EU referendum. Today, really? Feels like it's been going on for ages already. The big guns have been out all week on both sides of the debate, and none so big as the International Monetary Fund and World Bank nailing their colours firmly to the Remain mast. The IMF downgrading even its growth forecast for the UK this year, blaming Brexit uncertainty, which could cause severe global economic damage.
Well, today we have a stark warning from the IMF. For the first time, they're saying that the threat of Britain leaving the EU is having an impact on our economy, and they've cut our growth forecast as a result. They say if we were actually to leave the EU, there would be a short-term impact on stability and a long-term cost for the economy. So this is the clearest independent warning of the taste of things to come if we leave the EU. I think we're much better off if we stay in the EU. That would make Britain stronger, safer and better off.
Well, that was Chancellor George Osborne there. But Eurosceptics, like former Chancellor Norman Lamont, say no, 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 our economy is performing far better than the Eurozone.
I don't see why there should be disruption to trade. There are other countries in the continent of Europe that are outside the EU that trade with it. We know we would have several years, nothing would change in that time. The idea that this is going to cause a disruption in trade, I think, is purely alarmist.
Well, not to be outdone, the Bank of England also got involved, warning that leaving could hurt our economy, as it held interest rates again this week at its historic low of 0.5%. Now, that's despite the surprise rise in inflation for March to its highest level in over a year. All nine members of the Monetary Policy Committee voting to keep the base rate where it's been quite firmly since March 2009. So lots in that, Simon. Brexit, inflation figures, interest rates, IMF warnings, put them all together, shake them all up, what do you get?
That we are no clearer on the direction of future travel than we were before anybody made any of those announcements. Had we have gone back, if we jumped in the DeLorean and went back to last Friday, we would know no more about the future than we do now, having had all of those things happen in the past week.
The IMF.
Look, I mean, is anybody surprised that the IMF, led by Christine Lagarde, has come out on the anti-Brexit side, on the pro-EU anti-Brexit side? I mean, Christine Lagarde is a poster woman for the whole idea of eurocracy and, you know, that whole Eurocrat EU thing. I think that it is absolutely no surprise that she's come down on that side. I think it's absolutely no surprise the IMF has come down on that side. I think it's absolutely no surprise that the World Bank has come down on that side. I think that all of these organisations represent the same kind of technocratic style of authority that perhaps all the people who are angry about the EU resent. So it comes as no surprise. My comment would be that, you know, I'm looking at Alex Brummer's column here, the Daily Mail City editor today, and he said, in practical terms, the IMF is promising a special chapter in its annual inspection of the UK economy, dealing with Brexit and quantifying the effects. Lagarde gave no clues as to the contents, but the tone of her remarks left little doubt that the fund and its economists already have made up their mind that Brexit would be bad for Britain, bad for the EU, because it would lead to at least 2 years of uncertainty, and bad for the globalised world. And Alex goes on to say, one suspects that most people in the pig and whistle don't have a clue who Lagarde is. However, he adds that when this sentiment is adopted and propagated by the Remain campaign as the verdict of the world's most important financial institution, it is certain to have impact and work well for what has been dubbed Project Fear. And I think that is true. But I would say that I think the economic thing is a red herring here. People aren't going to vote yes or no, Remain or Leave, based on the economy. It's a political question, and it's a political power and a political control question. And I think, you know, Neil Woodford, the fund manager, we talked about this before, he did a big report on this. And basically, his report, which was independent, came out and said, probably won't make any difference to the economy. And actually, I think I trust Woodford's report more than Christine Lagarde's sentiment.
That being said, and the reality being that, well, no one actually knows what is going to happen, but is all the speculation, the downgrading, etc., doing something materialistic anyway to Britain's economy?
Well, I think it certainly dented the pound, but these things move, they swing left, they swing right. So I think, yes, probably, markets, economies, people don't like uncertainty. That's the classic line that gets trotted out, and it's a truism. You know, people don't like uncertainty and people become more cautious because of it. At the same time, the world is becoming more cautious. Everyone's a little bit worried that some kind of major collapse is on the horizon. Something's going to blow up. There could be a global recession. There could be a US recession. There could be a stock market crash. So people are being cautious and businesses are being cautious. And I don't think that the Brexit speculation helps with that. But, you know, there's going to come a point where we're going to know the result of that referendum and then we can move on. I mean, there is then going to be the whole issue of if we do vote to leave, what on earth we sort out after that date. But, you know.
But that's it. You've just touched on it there. Brexit can't be the only culprit around the IMF's warning.
No,
it's obviously drowning out all the noise.
So let's posit an alternate sort of reality where basically everything's going swimmingly in the world. Nobody's worried about anything. Global economy's chipping along. Stock market's on the up. Then nobody's really going to be particularly worried about it. It'd be much less of a concern. But it provides just another big talking point. And I think when you look at these great global leaders that we have who are going to be talking about these problems, they've got China, you know, and they've got America and its election, and you've got Brexit. It's not there up there with China and America, but Brexit is there on their talking points.
So, Lee, the Bank of England also getting involved. We heard this week no budging of interest rates. Was there anything of interest in the MPC minutes? Let's be honest, there wasn't going to be anything of interest in regard to the rate itself. I suppose it could have gone negative. Likelihood of that?
I don't think that's going to be happening anytime soon. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it keeps getting dubbed Super Thursday. I mean, it's just never super. But I mean, the inflation has gone up a little in the last month. You know, all of this Brexit stuff is creating some sort of uncertainty. You know, whether that uncertainty is going to continue after, if there was a Brexit, who knows? One thing I will say in terms of Brexit is in the last week and a half, I've had two leaflets come through my letterbox. One is from the Leave campaign. One is from, you know, Remain. Both of them, bold writing on the front, fact. These are the facts about the EU, but they're contradicting themselves. So what is the actual fact? That's what I want to know. And I'm just the average man who's in the pig and whistle, and I don't want to, you know, be reading all this stuff. I just want actual, real, hard facts for someone independent like Neil Woodford, as Simon says there, and other people like that that don't have sort of real vetted interests or one way or the other. Sorry, I know I'm swerving a little bit, of course. Here.
No, but you've raised a really good point there, because the point of the government leaflets were to educate people about debate, educate them to Remain, obviously. But as journalists yourself, you know, it's your job to delve into these things, to find the facts and the truth. Give us advice. Give us, the people, some advice on how we can sort through and sift through all this speculation and actually find out what are the nub of the issues.
Well, I firstly think you've got to have an open mind. I don't think you could just like battle straight in and go, I want to leave because of this, this and this, or I want to remain because of this, this and this. You've really got to sit down, you've got to have a look, you've got to really read what actual facts there are out there that are not propaganda, and you've got to have a real think about what sort of key issues for you that you want to, you know, sort of, do you want to take control back from Europe? Are we better, stronger together, you know, safer together in the wake of terrorism and all those sort of things? And it's a really difficult subject, and so many people that I speak to are undecided. You know, we're only sort of 6 weeks, 2 months away from the referendum. And people, you know, it's not a sort of decision that you can rush into. I can't see people going into the polling station going, oh, I'm just going to go for one or the other. I mean, I think people really are going to be thinking about this. This is a, you know, massive decision. And, like, you know, there's a lot of noise from the IMF saying, oh, you know, this, it could create massive uncertainty. It's all, we don't know what will happen if the Brexit happened, you know, and you know, you can't look at these forward reports. As Simon points out, you know, a vetted interest in this. You know, people that behind the IMF want us to stay in Europe. Of course they're going to say, oh, it's going to rock Britain, you know, rock the economy. And, you know, you've got to take these things with a pinch of salt.
You do indeed. There's lots of speculation around. You did touch on inflation figures there and sort of taking out the Brexit part of it, up from 0.3% in January to 0.5% February, slightly more than expectations. But the Bank of England expecting inflation to remain below 1% for the rest of the year, under 2% target until 2018. Anything of note in those figures, Lee?
Well, the actual reason, it seems to be the biggest reason why inflation went up, was airfares. So airfares has absolutely soared because of Easter, and that's what, you know, made the inflation figure go up.
22.9%, I believe.
That's quite bonkers. That's just...
The reason is because Easter normally falls in April. Sometimes, occasionally, it falls right at the end of March. It fell at the end of March, and so airfares went up in March. And it's basically as simple as that. It's a statistical anomaly that everyone knows about. Yet every time it ever happens, we still report it and go, wow, look at what just happened.
So taking that out then, what would the figures have been?
I think they probably would have been a notch lower. Yeah. Still 0.3, 0.4. I think monthly inflation figures are too... They're volatile. You should never really look at monthly figures. What you need to be looking at is the sort of longer term trend. And okay, yes, the inflation figures I'm measuring compared to a year ago, but because of the way inflation is measured, you still need to be a bit careful about it. It's when you start seeing a number of months in a row that it starts going up. And to be fair, it has gone up now for a number of months in a row. So if it doesn't stall, if it keeps notching up, you know, by another 0.1, 0.2% each month, and in 6 months' time, we're up near to 1%, then people will actually start to be being concerned about inflation, despite the fact that inflation is well below target.
Yeah, we're hearing higher clothing, 1.7%. Food prices fell 3%. Now, Tesco released positive figures this week, but boss Dave Lewis warned of deflationary environment.
It's still a difficult market, and we need to invest in a market which is very tough. and very challenging, but we're clearly very focused on what it is we need to do. I can see many, many, many more things that myself and colleagues in Tesco need to do. It's the most uncertain, deflationary market that we've seen in retail for a very long time. That's good news for customers, but this is an industry which has a lot of challenges, not just our prices declining, but our costs are increasing. So no, unfortunately, I'm not sitting here thinking that the job will get easier, but I am sitting here thinking that we've created some optionality for the business, and that's what myself and the team have been trying to do since I arrived.
What do you make of that, Lee?
I think, actually, in the last sort of 6 months or so, Tesco has done things, little things that I think have helped improve the supermarket. I, for one, have been going back into Tesco here and there. I'm edging back in there. Some of them are a little chaotic, but they seem to be ironing out a few of these issues. But he's completely correct there. I mean, 3% fall in a year is great news for, you know, all of us, because at the end of the day, we all got to go and do a supermarket shop. Big, big reason for this is Aldi and Lidl. You know, they're cutting into market share. You know, prices are lower than they tend to be in, you know, Sainsbury's, your Tesco's, your Asda. You know, they're cutting into their market share. And these supermarkets are having to react, you know, as a result of that. And it's great news for us going to the supermarket.
Is that why, Simon, despite the fact that Tesco reported profit, given, goodness me, those losses last year, the share price was down so much because of this environment Lee's just spoken about there?
Yeah, that's exactly why. And the other reason is because the Tesco share price had already risen quite a lot in recent months in the expectation that things were getting better. So what you got this week was the confirmation that that expectation was correct, but the concern that you couldn't continue with those expectations. And to keep the momentum of a share moving upwards in a market as difficult as the supermarket sector, then you need to keep having that expectation. Things are going to get better, things are going to get better, things are going to get better. But I think maybe the market might have marked down Tesco a bit too much, actually, the other day. I think, regardless of the difficult environment it's operating in, a difficult environment largely, as Lee pointed out, of its own making. Mm-hmm. You know, the reason why we have food deflation is because all the supermarkets are involved in a price war. There is the scenario where I think Tesco is getting better. You know, it was in a bit of a mess, to be honest. It was in a bit of a mess on its corporate side. And it was in a bit of a mess in its shops. You know, it was taking its customers for granted. And to be honest, its food just wasn't that good. And there's a lot more appealing food on Tesco's shelves now than there was 2 years ago. And I think that is what is pulling people in. And I'll go back to this time and time again. Aldi and Lidl promote themselves on quality first and price second. That is why they were winning customers, not just because they were cheap. Because let's face it, places that sell cheap food have existed for donkey's years, and none of them have done as well as Aldi and Lidl did.
And that's why they do so well in our taste test. I do want to know, before we move on from this, do you think you're going to see a big player fall in this environment in the next couple of years?
Ooh, that's a difficult question. I wouldn't have thought so. I mean, if there was one that was probably a little bit susceptible, it would be Morrisons, in my opinion. Mm. Obviously, it had that disastrous M Local launch, which, you know, really they were late in the market in every way possible on that. And I don't know if they're really sort of cutting into the sort of southern market. You know, I always think of it as a more northern-based supermarket. I don't know if they've done enough to really sort of get people to be going there on a regular basis, and that could potentially be their downfall. Do I think it would disappear? No, I mean, I think it would be okay, but I still think it's got some rocky times ahead.
Simon?
Well, I think actually one of the things that, you know, possibly didn't get as reported as much the other day, and I don't have the exact figures to hand here, was that Tesco paid down quite a bit of debt. And it's debt that sinks companies, mm-hmm. really, at the end of the day. You can keep fighting when market conditions are tough, but if you start to struggle with your debts and you start getting, you know, breaching covenants and getting loans called in, which Tesco wasn't, you know, anywhere near doing, but that's the key. And I don't think that any of those big supermarkets have got that kind of problem. And certainly Tesco was the one that people were a bit worried about the debt. And that's why it's been selling off all these businesses, you know, to try and pull in some capital to pay off its debts and to put its balance sheet in a better position. So I think maybe we've seen the worst for them and one of them won't fall. But I tell you what, I reckon one of them will get bought out. Maybe it'll be Morrisons that does get bought out.
We shall see. But before we move on from Brexit fears and warnings we were talking about a little bit earlier, there are more about, and I have to ask you, this time it's for the housing market. We've got some other stats from the ONS this week showing UK house price inflation slowed to 7.6% in the year to February from January's 7.9%. Excluding London and the South East, UK house prices grew 5% in that time. But with the referendum looming, combined with buy-to-let jitters and the impact of the weakening pound, well, it's fueled talk we could be set for a climate of uncertainty brewing. But this waning confidence won't last for long, according to the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, who say over the next 5 years, property prices could increase by around 25%, which rather reflects research from the charity Shelter, which claims by 2020, first-time buyers will need a £64,000 pay packet and a £46,000 deposit to afford an average home. Don't even ask about the figure in London. It's over £100,000. 29-year-old Richard Hill can't afford to live in the capital where he works, so he stays with his parents in Essex.
The only way I foresee it being possible to sort of own my own property is if I move well away from London and Essex. The other alternative is to rent, but then obviously you're never going to be in a situation to save for your house deposit, and you're going to be trapped in that bubble of rent.
Well, I know Lee's got first-hand experience of this, but first let's hear from Kate Webb from the charity Shelter.
The problem is so much of the government's attention is focused on helping people who are actually quite well off just move onto the housing ladder and maybe buy a slightly bigger home or buy slightly earlier than they would have otherwise. There's a big gap around solutions for people on low to middle incomes, and that's why we're saying the government needs to really focus on building homes that ordinary people can afford to either rent or buy. People on ordinary incomes are really caught between a rock and a hard place. In many areas, the idea of owning your own home is becoming a pipe dream. So more and more people are stuck renting, but rents are going up as well. So people are finding that they're paying huge amounts of their income on rent. They can't afford to save for a deposit. Often they can be chucked out with very little notice. So it's not just that people are frustrated and not being able to buy. It's also that the only options available for them are expensive and insecure. We're seeing that people really are adapting how they have to live their lives in response to this. So we're seeing more and more people living with their parents into their 30s. We're seeing people giving up on certain areas, so more people moving out of London. Big impacts on relationships. People tell us that they're delaying having children. They're perhaps staying in relationships which aren't actually good for them because they can't afford to live independently. We're calling for the government to invest in more homes that people on ordinary incomes can afford to rent or buy.
That was Kate Webb there from Shelter. Lee, is Richard Hill a mate of yours?
I can really sort of resonate with what he's saying. I've got lots of friends in that situation. This is a bit of a problem in London and the South East. It's a real catch-22 situation because you either come to London and you rent, it's very unlikely that you're going to be able to afford somewhere to live. A lot of the jobs, it's such a massive hub, London. That is where most people from Essex, from Kent, from these sort of surrounding areas want to come and work. Now, the catch-22 situation I'm talking about is then people have got to be footing the train bill. So you've got your train fares, you've got rent, then you're saving up for a deposit, and it's all these things that you're trying to juggle in your life. And it's very difficult. And talking there about building new affordable homes, in the area that I'm in at the moment, in Essex, I've never seen such a level of house building going on. There's like new estates going up absolutely everywhere, all very close to the train station, so links into London. That train is already sort of on its knees. So is the infrastructure getting the same sort of funding? I don't know. I mean, Crossrail is coming in the next couple of years, but I still don't think it's going to be enough. So there's so many things to be juggling here. And it's a really tough situation for people. I feel so bad for people that, might be, I say trapped in renting, but it's true. You're trapped in renting. You're paying money to a landlord, and that's money you could have been saving towards a deposit, which you can no longer really afford a place in London, especially if you're single. Even as a couple, it's a massive stretch.
Simon, is this what we're seeing? The house prices, strongest growth is in places like Essex in the South East because it's better value for money. People can't afford to live in London. Where else are we seeing the changes in house prices?
Well, it's this sort of wave of money coming out of London at the moment in the commuter belt. So there's people selling up who've lived there for some time, families deciding that they're going to move out and get more space, get more room, bring their kids up. And that's always been something that has happened. You know, that's not a new trend. It's not like everybody suddenly just woke up one day and went, we're going to move out of London. But there's such a big disparity between how much house prices in London and those in-demand areas have risen, especially for those people who live, you know, within zones one to, well, probably none of them live in zone one, so let's just qualify that. Zones two or three, basically. Yeah, that's happening. But then you have some people going, well, I can't afford to move to what would have been the traditional commuter towns. You know, the St Albans has been priced, I've been priced well out of St Albans. So I'm going to go up the train line. Now, I know this area because I grew up in Harpenden. Now, if they can't afford St Albans, they can't afford Harpenden. So then they go to Luton. Now, we've seen prices in Luton rise substantially over the last couple of years because people look at it and it is a relatively affordable place to live where you can get to London in 35 minutes on the train. And so you start to see these pockets, but then you start to see the people who lived in those pockets, maybe they think, oh, my house is cash, I'm going to cash in on this and I'm going to move slightly further out. So this is how you get this wave of movement going around. Now, the only problem is that this is all happening from a point where properties are already very expensive compared to wages. So under normal circumstances where in a market you see prices rise substantially, get into the bubble territory, as we know, and then they crash. The market corrects itself. We didn't let the market correct itself properly in 2008. We put every possible prop underneath it that we could do, including super low interest rates. And that means that despite us seeing prices hit a very, very high level in 2007, 2008, they then didn't really fall to where they should have fallen to. And so we're starting again in the housing cycle from a position where they're already more expensive. So I think Shelter is right, actually, but I don't think Shelter's very good at defining. I think it's very good at putting out surveys and releases and reports that catch headlines, but I don't think it's very good at getting across in those surveys and reports and headlines what it's actually talking about when it means affordable housing, because it's not talking about house builders building normal family homes that they sell to families. It's talking about a whole new generation of affordable housing to replace what used to be, you know, the local authority's responsibility, council housing and things like that. And that's actually what we need to be building, because the real gap in the market is what once would have been council homes. You know, we just don't build any of those anymore.
Well, that's Shelter. That's your views as well. Also, the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, with their warnings about this short-term waning confidence. What are they saying? Brexit fears? What impact are they worried about here?
Well, we've tipped over to the other side, according to the RICS survey, where they ask their member estate agents every month what their sentiment is. What's going to happen? Are house prices going to go up? Are they going to go down? Are you selling more? Are you selling less? How long is it taking to sell? Do you have more on your books? And a balance of 2% more surveyors expect to see house prices fall rather than rise over the coming months. And that's 3 months ahead, basically. But then they're saying, over the next 5 years, still a problem with supply and demand. Too many people, not enough houses, property prices will increase by about 25%. Although, actually, 25% over 5 years isn't that much.
Coming up, just how do you solve a problem like inheritance tax?
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
And we'll stick with the housing theme, perhaps the thing that comes to mind most when we think about inheritance tax.
Where does all the money go?
Well, a lot of it goes to Her Majesty.
And the Beatles, it's been in the news a fair bit of late thanks to David Cameron's £200,000 gift from his mum. Now, Simon, you've been looking into this rather controversial tax, but first let's hear from Danny Clifford from Ensor's Accountants.
Inheritance tax is a tax effectively designed to charge gifts that are made either on death or during lifetime. Now, most people will always associate with death because that's the point at which we will understand that inheritance tax may be payable, and it's payable at 40%, and you have your nil rate band set against that. That's not the only time it's in fact chargeable. It can be chargeable on some lifetime gifts as well. It really depends how things are structured, but essentially it's a tax that can bite on any transfer from one person to another, although most of the time it doesn't because most lifetime gifts are covered by exemptions. There's the idea that I have a lot of sympathy with, to be honest, where people will say, well, if I've earned the money, I've paid income tax at the point where I've earned it, and then I have to pay another 40% inheritance tax if I haven't spent it by the time I die. It does seem extremely unfair on that basis. Against that, you would have people arguing that without something, some mechanism to tax transfers from one generation to another, you could have people who just consistently passed down through the family, and therefore that person who's now leaving it didn't actually earn it at all. They were merely left it. So it's a mechanism by which you're seeking to stop a complete flow from generation to generation within a family. The one we all associate with is essentially the 40% inheritance tax that's due on a death. It's actually payable on all UK CITES assets. So even if you're a non-domiciled individual living in India, if you happen to own a property in the UK and you die, then that property is liable to inheritance tax. UK domiciles will pay inheritance tax on all UK assets, but we will also pay inheritance tax on all our worldwide assets. So if I own a property in the UK, I'll pay inheritance tax on that when I die, but I would also have to pay if I owned a property in the USA or France or wherever. So there's a difference if you're domiciled or non-domiciled in the UK as to what you pay it on. But essentially, it's payable by everybody on all UK assets and by UK domiciles on all of their assets worldwide.
Well, that was Annie Clifford there from NSAW's accountant. So, Simon, I will pose the question to you that you've been looking at. Just how do you solve a problem like inheritance tax?
Well, I think, first of all, you need to ask why we have a problem, which is what I did in my column, really, because I think the Prime Minister found himself...
That's it. Why have you been looking at this?
So the Prime Minister, basically, his father died. And when his father died, I believe he left, you know, not everything to his mum. I think he left a certain amount to Cameron, Mr. Cameron, and then everything else to his mum. You can pass assets on death totally free of tax between spouses, married partners, so basically between a married couple, civil partners. And then she gave David Cameron £200,000. Now, if she lives for 7 years after the date of that gift, which let's hope she does, there is no inheritance tax to pay on it because it becomes exempt from inheritance tax due to something called the 7-year rule. Now, this is just simply the way that inheritance tax is structured. And it is very strange to see someone basically lambasted, as David Cameron was, for playing by the rules of the tax. In the tax avoidance sort of stakes, this is basically the same level of tax avoidance as putting money into an ISA so that you don't pay tax on the interest. We might be talking about a much larger sum of money, which I think is the key problem here in many people's eyes, but it is no more aggressive tax avoidance than paying money into an ISA. It is quite literally playing by the rules. But everybody, you know, there's a big debate about this. People are up in arms. So it's thrown inheritance tax back into the limelight. Now, the funny thing about inheritance tax is that basically people really, really dislike it. And there's various polls that are done that, you know, take a measure of how much they dislike it. And
the one on your website, isn't
it? Yeah, the one on our website. The one that gets cited the most is actually quite old now. It comes from 2004, and it was done by Ipsos Mori, which showed that 69% of people thought that IHT was unfair. Now, that's quite interesting, because actually, as it stands, only 1 in 20 estates actually pay inheritance tax now. And even though that's rising, more people are being pulled into the net. The Office of Budget Responsibility expects it only to become 1 in 10 by 2019. So there is a vast swathe of the population out there that has a huge objection to a tax that most of them will never, ever, ever face. So you have to question why this is. And I think it is because people really dislike the concept of building up a lifetime wealth that they would like to leave to their families. People earn money to provide for their families, to leave for their families. They want their children to have a better life, their grandchildren to have a better life. They really dislike the idea of building up that pot of wealth and then the tax man taking 40% of it, even though there's quite a generous allowance. And I think that what we have to look at with inheritance tax is that basically people dislike it so much, the argument is lost for all of those who... There's lots of people who'd like to raise it, who'd like to have more inheritance tax. But, I mean, I think that argument is lost. You know, the Tory pledge to raise inheritance tax to £1 million was credited with being what was one of the main things that won them election into the coalition. And it actually prompted Alistair Darling to introduce this thing where you can transfer your £325,000 unused allowance to your, you know, surviving spouse. So, effectively, it encouraged the Labour government to pretty much effectively double inheritance tax for families. But then in coalition, the Tories couldn't raise it to £1 million. And then they still haven't felt that they could do that. So they've introduced, George Osborne's introduced this bizarre family home allowance where you get an extra £175,000 per mother or father married couple for the family home. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to take people out of inheritance tax at the same time as the government's trying to rake in more money from it. And at the same time as they're trying to appease people who, if they do anything to raise inheritance tax, like raising it to £1 million, they would get criticised for handing money to the rich. So essentially we have a problem.
Isn't also the problem rising property prices bringing that in, particularly in the southeast and London?
Yes. So basically, I mean, inheritance tax in the UK is essentially a social and geographical thing. So basically you're either wealthy and successful or you have a house in London and the south. Mm. And broadly speaking, that's kind of like a Venn diagram thing. Those two things overlap. But it is very much a geographical issue. But what's really interesting is even all of those people living in the north who aren't going to get hit by inheritance tax, still a lot of them don't like the idea of it. We did our own poll, and bearing in mind this is probably going to be swayed by our readership, because they were the ones answering it. But we asked, do you think inheritance tax is fair? 10% of people said yes, and 90% of people said no. So 90% of our readers think inheritance tax is unfair. So what's
that's
the problem?
No small poll. That's about 1,000 people there.
Yeah, that's 1,000 people, yeah. And then what would you do to IHT? Cut it, 79%. Raise it, 18%. Do nothing, 4%. So I think what you've got to look at here is, A, what's caused this problem? Basically property prices. It's rising property prices. Inheritance tax was designed to like split up large estates, large landed estates. It wasn't designed to just hit people who lived in a family home that's happened to have gone up in value. What's the real problem? The real problem, I think, is actually it's just how much it is. It's just the 40% thing. In people's minds, that translates as the government takes nearly half. And then that comes down to that I've already paid tax on this. This is money I've already paid tax on. Now, actually, when you consider that it's most people's properties values that pull them into this, and it's the rise in that, they haven't really paid tax on that at all. We're not talking about money they've built up in their savings from their income. We're largely talking about the rise in their home's value. So what is inheritance tax really? It's actually a capital gains tax on property when you die, realistically. So what do you do about this thing? Well, the 40% number is the big problem. My argument is cut it to 20%. Figure becomes much more palatable. Less people worry about it. There's much less incentive to avoid it. Even if you were very, very rich, you look at 20% and you go, it's a relatively small percentage. I'm probably not going to spend all of the money I spend on avoiding this tax. And I think that you just kill the problem off once and for all. And I said that doesn't play into schemes to rake in more money from rising property prices, but it does sound fair and it is simple. And by any measure of a tax, that is a good one.
Lee, why don't you just get rid of it altogether?
Well, it's one of those, isn't it? It's really difficult to say, oh, let's get rid of it, because at the end of the day, the government gets something like 1% of its income from inheritance tax. So if you start axing that, then we're starting looking at where they're going to cut even more, you know, parts of what have already sort of been cut anyway. I totally agree with Simon. I thought his column was very good this week.
I don't doubt.
40%, it does. It sounds like half, and that is such a massive slab of money. I think it even needs to go down to 20%. 20%, or even if there was some sort of tiered system. But then I think tiered system, and I think George Osborne, I think, oh man, I mean, you just don't know.
But also painful for an already struggling next generation from that perspective, maybe.
Exactly. A lot of people will have a home that, you know, they want to give to their parents, to their children, who are struggling.
Chances are, will not get their own.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's the whole argument, isn't it? I mean, you could either get that house and then sell it on and then buy yourself a property and get yourself on a property ladder in that way. But once 40% has been, you know, taken out of it, I mean, that does leave you a little bit, especially if you there's, you know, let's say you've got brothers and sisters or whoever it's been left with, you could end up with not an awful amount of money.
And I mean, the answer to this, you know, obviously, to go back to the why are we talking about this, the David Cameron situation, the answer to this is you just give the money away before you die. And then you've got to live 7 years. 7 years is a long time, though. And the reason that seven-year rule exists is so that it is to stop people giving away money anywhere near their deathbed, basically. And it's weighted very, very heavily in the tax man's favour, that 7 years. But this is something that, to go back to what Lee was saying about people and properties in their home areas, it's like there is a whole generation growing up, basically, who won't be able to afford to live in the same kind of home that their parents lived in their hometown. And this is something I reflected on that unites people in two places that I've lived in my life. My hometown of Harpenden, where house prices are ridiculously high, and North London, where I live now. Both home-owning families, long-term home-owning families, in both of those areas will have the same concern about their kids being able to ever afford to live in the same kind of home, in the same kind of area. And that is why this issue unites the constituents of Peter Lilly, the Tory in Harpenden, and Jeremy Corbyn, my MP in North Islington.
You're listening to Consuming Issues. Simon Lambert, Lee Boyce here with me. Now, we've been discussing inheritance tax, haven't we, which some people may think is a bit of a swindle, but let's turn to something far less debatable, and that's banking account fraud, which has been called an epidemic. But if you are a victim, bad luck. You could be on your own. Just 2 in 1,000 cases are ever investigated. 70% of those affected are told it's their fault for giving away their details so easily. Lee, firstly, what exactly is bank account fraud?
Well, there's a whole array of frauds out there that scammers are using to raid your current account. We're talking vishing, which is where fraudsters phone you up, pretending to be from the bank, saying that you've been a victim of fraud. They convince you to transfer your money into one of their accounts. There's smishing, which is where you get a text message and, again, you get duped into part of your cash. There's courier fraud. There's so many frauds out there. And a lot of people go, well, this will never happen to me. You know, I'm too wise, I'm too astute for this to happen. The thing is, these fraudsters really know what they're doing, and as the years are going past, they're getting more experienced at it, and they know what works. So you've got to be on your guard. So this investigation that I did actually looked at action fraud. So what happens? If you're a victim of fraud, you will probably contact your bank and say, I've been a victim of fraud. Now, in 7 in 10 cases, banks are going, you know, it's your own fault. You've given out your details, you've been grossly negligent, we're not going to issue a refund.
Which they're entitled to do?
They've been entitled to do, but it's such a grey area. So, you know, what a lot of banks I found are doing are going, well, take it to the financial ombudsman. And the ombudsman, you know, almost half of cases are going, well, you should have refunded in that circumstance. So you can see now, because it's becoming a bigger problem, banks are trying to sort of wash their hands a little bit of it. Action fraud is a sort of middleman to this. So it was set up a few years ago. It's had a number of issues in the past, losing details, call centres. Yeah, the centre that handles all this is quite small, and because fraud cases are growing, they're struggling to handle what's coming in. You will be told to contact Action Fraud to log if you've been a victim of a scam. Now, what they do is give you a crime reference number, like you would from the police. A lot of people are thinking that means that they're looking into it. You know, they're investigating this fraud. They're going to catch the bad guys that are doing this. What I've been told by Action Fraud is actually 8 out of 10 cases are pretty much binned straight off. Large factor of that is that the money ends up overseas. Because of certain jurisdictions, it's very difficult for them to be able to trace the money. So they go, well, it's unrealistic for us to look into those.
How much money are you talking about? There's a couple hundred, 1,000 lifetime savings?
Lifetime savings. You know, people, fraudsters are really targeting high wealth individuals. They're targeting the elderly. They know the elderly are less likely to probably be clued up on some of these scams because, you know, they're more trusting. You know, they've gone decades without any of these sort of problems coming about. Also, businesses, small businesses are a massive target because fraudsters know likelihood they're going to have hundreds of thousands of pounds in their accounts. Likelihood is also that they make numerous transactions every day, so it won't be flagged up as suspicious with the banks. My biggest problem is the fact that people think this is being investigated, and to be honest with you, they're struggling to cope. They told me they had 30,000 points of contact last month. People calling in, people emailing in with their, you know, cases. They've got 70 members of staff, and that doesn't add up to me. That's quite a low number for a growing problem.
Yeah, incredibly low number. So the banks are washing their hands with us. Action fraud don't have the staff. Police can't do it either. Elderly, you just said, particularly vulnerable here. How can we build an infrastructure that's going to protect us?
Well,
we do.
They have announced, actually, over the weekend that IBM have won a contract to improve the action fraud service, which is going to make it easier for people to report the crimes online. But the thing is, you know, look at police forces up and down the country, you know, they're getting staff cut. You know, there's over-the-counter services are being cut in police. You know, how much backroom staff is there to allow for these sort of cyber crimes? I don't know. I mean, it's probably quite a low number, if I'm being frank with you. And what also I've been told from an insider is cases don't really get investigated unless they can link it into a wider, bigger gang, so they can like bust some of these gang rings. But there's loads of people, and more fraudsters are coming about, I'm afraid.
Well, if you are particularly vulnerable, the elderly, it's bad news. But thankfully, This Is Money, I have a special treat for the over 65. You've been looking at 10 pots of cash and freebies that you could be entitled to, and importantly, how to claim them. It sounds we're hearing today more than 40% of pensioners are regretting retirement planning mistakes which have left them struggling financially. So, Simon, help out.
Well, just before we move on to that, I would like to add one thing to the whole banking fraud thing, which is to say that Lee's investigation was really good, and Lee deserves a lot of praise on this, because Lee has basically been tirelessly investigating all of this stuff, this fraud stuff, this phishing stuff, for the last couple of years, and he has been at the forefront, you know, of raising awareness about this. And we had a campaign to say that banks weren't doing enough to raise awareness about it, and that actually had some success, where the banks started doing more to raise awareness about it. But it's basically journalists like Lee who make a real difference here. And I think that it's really important to remember that. And so I think he deserves a lot of praise, because there will almost certainly not only be some people out there who were helped by Lee and other journalists like mm-hmm. him, but there will be many people who basically were prevented from losing their life savings, who thought, oh, actually, this might be a scam, and they didn't get caught out. So hats off.
Well done, Lee.
Can I go home for the weekend?
Pay rise?
So, over 65s, you want some free money?
I just want some free money, come on.
Right, so Rachel basically went through and listed 10 things that you can get if you're over 65 that you might not be getting. £25 if there is a cold snap, the cold weather payment. These are £25 payments for each 7-day period of very cold weather between November and March. March has now passed, so you mm-hmm. have to wait till next year. Extra pension payments, 2 pension credits. Now, there has long been a situation where many pensioners do not claim the money that they are owed. And one of those great ones is actually pension credits. So, you know, really, you should be taking these top-ups where you can. The winter fuel allowance, this is a controversial one. Everybody is entitled to this. Anyone born before May the 6th, 1953, is eligible for an annual payment of between £100 and £300. And there was a situation where basically wealthier households were saying, how do I give this back? And they were struggling to give it back. So if you do get it and you want to give it back, give it to charity. Money off your council tax, help towards hospital travel costs, free Strictly Come Dancing.
What is that?
I know. This is just Rachel's fancy way of saying that you're entitled to a free TV licence. It's all these people reading it going, oh, how do I get to the studio? Maybe I can use my bus pass to get there for free as well.
You can do.
Lost pensions or bank accounts? Track them down, people. Don't let the banks get them or the government. Free eye tests. Free travel to get you to your free Strictly Come Dancing. And finally, help with housing costs. If you're on a low income and rent property, you may be eligible for help towards your housing costs. This is means tested and it's available to people of all ages, not just those aged over 65. So there you go. Go
Loads.
To thisismoney.co.uk/pensions and you will find the full list and also the details in there of how to claim these things.
Probably, though, the best thing that you could have done, though, is got yourself a really great job that paid loads of money. So you've been also looking at the university subjects that ultimately pay off. So if you are perhaps coming up to college age or you're thinking of re-enrolling as an older student, which subjects will get you the furthest? And which are just a waste of time.
What do you regret studying at uni?
Technical writing.
Economics.
Shakespeare.
Media.
Network society and the media.
I don't regret anything because I didn't take a degree until I was much, 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 much older. I left school and went straight to work and did a degree in my 40s.
What's the subject you regret at university the most?
Oh, I didn't go to uni.
Do you regret that?
No.
No, there you go. That was a bit of a Share Radio office poll there. A bit worrying, all those media comments. But what did you find out, Lee?
So that was brilliant. Well, actually, somebody said economics there. That was number 2 in the list of what you get the highest salary
for. It doesn't
for.
Work for everyone, though,
doesn't
does it?
Doesn't work for everyone, no. So the top 5 of this survey that's been done. So it's a real sort of in-depth look at, you know, people that went to uni, I think, between 98 and 2011. So it's a big old pool of people. Mm-hmm. They've looked at tax data. They've looked at all sorts of data to pull this together. So it is a very good report. The top 5 subjects for earning, you know, good amounts of money once you've graduated. Number 1 is medicine. Number 2, economics. Number 3, engineering and technology. Number 4, law, and number five, physical sciences. So you're quite, you know, I would say boffin type subjects there, but you obviously have to be quite smart and talented in the first place to be accepted onto these degrees. At the bottom of the list, I suppose it's not that surprising, is creative arts. You probably, if you're doing a creative arts degree, you're not...
What's creative arts?
Well, you know, it's probably things like drama. Oh, right. But if you make it big, you know, if you make it big as an actor or as an actress, you could be making millions. But, you know, it's one of those subjects you probably do it more out of the love than thinking, oh, I'm going to, you know, make loads and loads of money out of this. But, you know, it's one of those lists. You go to university, you study what you want to do and what you think's best for you.
Best one was Beckham Studies, David Beckham Studies. Surf science, rather
that
like
sounds,
that.
That
well.
Sounds quite
Where
good.
Where did history come in that?
History, well, it came really quite middle of the list.
All right.
History and philosophy. For a female, £23,000 is the average wage for a graduate when you come out, and £26,000 for a male graduate in history and philosophy.
That's a whole nother debate, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Gender pay gap. Thank you very, very much, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce. Final word from Simon.
I think that you also need to look at how much work you have to do to earn these salaries. So in medicine, 10 years out, you're earning the most money, but you're probably working an awful lot of hours. And also, doctors don't get paid that much when they're newly qualified, and Jeremy Hunt wants them to be paid even less.
Very good point there. They didn't have 4 hours at university, did they? Thank you very much, Editor Simon Lambert.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. Looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.